Thank you. Welcome to this afternoon's session. I hope you enjoyed the lunch. My job is just to introduce the second half and to introduce Charlie Leadbetter. When we were setting this up, I asked if I could do this slot because I've read his book, Living on Thin Air, which is much better than the books that are contained in his bio. He won't mind me saying that. When you do these things, people send you little bits about who they are and what they've done. And one of the things that's in Charlie's biography that he's one of the GQ voted in the top 30 influential thinkers in Britain. And when I asked him about it, he said, well, I'll tell you the story, is that I use the same hairdresser as the editor of GQ. So that's how he got in it. So just so you know that. So what I'm going to tell you is a couple things about him. He comes from Basingstoke, so you'll know all about culture. And and he's got a real affection for the amateur. But I do commend him to you, and I hope you enjoy his speech. Charlie Leadbetter.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Gavin, for that introduction, which wasn't the introduction that my mother faxed over to him earlier. I should say that, unfortunately, I woke up this morning with a rather violent stomach upset. So if I turn a funny colour at some point, that's why. And if anyone's got a Rennie, if they could just deposit it on the stage, that would be very good. Or just a stick of chalk would probably help. And as Gavin said, I'm one of those people who it's easier to say what they used to do than what they currently do. I used to be a journalist. I worked at the Financial Times and then at the Independent. And I found myself at the age of, I don't know, mid-30s, after several years in journalism, working 70 hours a week and seeing our kids for 10 minutes a day. And the more senior my job got and the swankier my title, the more boring my job got and the more boring I got. And I went from being a reasonably interesting person to being a very, very dull person. And so I just decided in 96 that I would change that and start working for myself. And I only had sort of one rule, which was I had to do things that were interesting to me, because if I was going to interest anyone else in them, they had to be interesting in me first, and I had to feel really enthusiastic about them. And so I started working from home. That was 10 years ago. My wife works from home. She's a journalist and novelist. And when we started this, we had two kids. Now we've got four kids, so it's been a very productive time. And you can do things when you work at home together that you can't normally do in the office, in normal office hours. My credentials for talking tonight are very limited, this afternoon are very limited, but I've just finished doing a project for the Arts Council about the future of arts organisations, called 21st Century Arts Organisations, in which I talked to about 80 different arts organisations. And I just thought I would, in the brief time available, just concentrate on, I suppose, the four or five main messages that I took away from that might be relevant to where you're at. And the first thing to say, in a way, is just how bewilderingly complex the environment that organisations like yours operate in seems. Are we living in the world of big brands and mega corporations that dominate sales? I don't know how many people here know that at the start of this year, Waterstones started a new system of ranking books, A to F. If your book is A, that is David Beckham's sexual autobiography, then they order millions. If your book's F, they order three. So are we living in that world, or are we living in the world that the editor of Wired, Chris Anderson, calls the long tail, where actually there are thousands and thousands of mini markets? So instead of there just being a few markets for a mass of products, actually there may be thousands of markets for very small audiences. The audience is fragmenting, becoming more demanding. That makes it more diverse, which is exciting. But in some ways, it makes it more tribal, more conservative. The competition is expanding. So the competition for leisure, creativity and culture is coming from all over the place. And many of you, not all of you, but many of you will be working with a public sector, which is probably coming at you from several directions and demanding different things. jobs, social inclusion, cultural capital, regeneration, education, what have you. So more partners, more audiences, more competition, more opportunity. How do you navigate your way through all of that? Well, just four thoughts. The first thing is the more complex the environment, the more important it is to keep it simple. And the more important it is to know why it is that you're doing what you're doing. When I did this tour of going around to different workshops with different groups, I put up this little chart and said, think about what you're doing, how you're going to do it, and for whom. And in one of our sessions, Ludo, who's now moved to the Royal Shakespeare Company, said, no, what you've got to think about is why you're doing it. And that question is absolutely right. If you don't know why it is you're doing what you're doing, then what hope have you to navigate your way through all this complexity? Because if you don't know why it is you're doing what you're doing, an opportunity will come along that will pull you that way, or you'll think there's some money over there. So you have to know why, and at the heart of that has got to be creativity. And it's got to be an account of how you manage creativity. I started working for myself because I read something in which someone said, if you look after the ideas, the money will follow. But just make sure you look after the ideas. If you look after the creativity, the rest will follow. It won't necessarily follow in exactly the way you want it, but looking after creativity is critical. And I was struck by the arts organisations that I talked to, how many in a way took for granted creativity. The idea of managing creativity is, of course, a slightly odd notion. Management is often about aligning resources around corporate plans and strategies. Creativity is often unplanned and comes from people who are deliberately misaligned or non-aligned. So the idea that you can manage creativity is a sort of odd notion, but you can certainly learn about where it comes from. Often comes from borrowing, often comes from combining diverse points of view. It often comes from trying things out in small markets first before you take them to big markets. So thinking hard about creativity, how you foster it, manage it, develop it, is really critical. And thinking about the value you create. I was struck in these conversations that people would keep on saying, we want to explain the value of what we do, but we don't want to explain it in terms of the public sector, in terms of targets, jobs, numbers of people educated. Nor do we think that commercial value entirely explains what we do. The box office counts, but that's not the only explanation, because you can make money in all sorts of different ways. And we know that art for art's sake doesn't define it. All artists on their own can't define value. We live in a more democratic age. So I think there's a desperate need for the arts community in general, led by the Arts Council in some ways, to engage in a debate about value. What is the value of art? Do we want to reduce it to instrumental things, or can we define it in other ways? Think about the way that the environment and sustainability has in 30 years become a social priority and the value attached to that. Think about the way that there's a consensus about enterprise and business now and the value of that. Well, how can we create in this country a consensus about the long-term value of art against which the arts sector works? The second thing, I think, is that whilst thinking about creativity within your organisations, I think it's critical that you think about creativity in wider society. And we are moving, I think, into a period of what you might call participative creativity or democratic innovation. And just a couple of very simple ways of explaining that. When I started work in journalism, I started work at the Financial Times. I started work on a typewriter, and I used to walk out through the printing presses. And there were two places in the newspaper that outsiders were allowed a view. If you wrote a letter, we would cut it in half and condescend to you, and if you were especially nice to us, we would print it. And if you knew the editor, you might get a piece on the op-ed page. Well, now, there are thousands of people engaged in some form of journalism called blogging. Just thousands, millions of them. So the tsunami comes along. CBS Television, one of the most powerful media operations in the world, has 11 foreign correspondents, several of them based in New York. Go on the web, there are 74,000 video clips of the tsunami. So this is a world in which the journalist, used to pontificating and giving its message out to the audience, suddenly finds that the readers want to become writers, and they want to become publishers, and they want to start doing what we want, what we're supposed to be doing. And it becomes very threatening. But if you mobilize that kind of mass creativity, then it can be extremely powerful. More and more creativity and innovation is going to come from users. Think about the mountain bike. I'm old enough, and I would guess half the audience looking at you is old enough to remember when there were only two kinds of bikes. There were racing bikes, which your elder brother rode in Eddie Merckx, and they were terribly glamorous but rather painful. And there were dad's, your bikes your dad rode, which sort of had handlebars like that. And then in the mid-70s, this thing came along called the mountain bike. Well, where did the mountain bike come from? Well, the traditional economic story would be the mountain bike came from some clever entrepreneur or innovator who came up with the idea, proved to be very popular, made big profits, and then other producers came into the mountain bike game. Well, the mountain bike started with users. It started with small groups of young, avid bikers in Northern California who were dissatisfied with the frailty of racing bikes. They wanted stronger frames. They took gears from the racing bike. They took the brakes from motorcycles. They amended different bits and pieces. And for 3-4 years, they created things that were known as clunkers. And it was 10 years before mountain bikes went into commercial manufacture on a very small scale. 30 years later, bike sales in America are worth $7 billion. 85% of them are mountain bikes, a category that didn't exist 30 years ago. And it came from the user. Now, I don't know what that means in the arts. I don't know what it means for theatres. But you're going to be operating in a world where people want to say back. It's going to be a two-way conversation. Ideas will not just flow down the pipeline out there. People will want to be part of the conversation, part of the productive activity. I'm not quite sure what it would look like if you had an auditorium where instead of everyone being seated so they can see all the action on the stage, the action suddenly started taking place all over the place. But in a way, the big goal in creative and cultural policy should be to expand the realm of creativity, to make creativity come from the auditorium, not just the stage. And enable people to do that. Point three, what does that mean for organisations? It means that arts organisations, like other organisations, are going to have to explore new models of organisation. And some arts organisations, especially smaller, newer ones, I think are models of new, networked, very flexible, highly adaptive, very entrepreneurial organisations. They also tend to be undercapitalised, underfunded, undermanaged. And live by seat-of-the-pants entrepreneurship. They feel very fragile. And then we have other older, bigger organisations that seem in some ways rather anachronistic and rather clumsy. Well, if you look around the world and look at where innovation comes from, it comes from new organisations, new kinds of organisation that are able to think and interact in different ways. 1995, 122 people trading on eBay. Now 122 million. The Sims, the biggest computer game in the world, computer games now outselling Hollywood, 90% of the content of The Sims comes from users. These are new organizational models that are platforms rather than pipelines. They're much more networked. There is a huge area here for arts organizations to explore. How do you become more networked? How do you share more resources? And can you do it in a way that's more efficient so that you can free up more time to be creative? That's the challenge. Too much of arts organisations' time is wasted on duplication, administration, and basic management that should be done much, much more efficiently to free up time to be creative. Final question, leadership, critical in all of this. Leadership has to be collaborative. It has to involve, if you like, political leadership, managerial leadership, and critically, creative leadership. I think these very good creative teams tend to be visionary opportunists. They don't have grand strategies, but they have a really inspiring vision, which means that when an opportunity comes along, they're often able to say, well, actually, it doesn't look like something for us, but how could we bend it to what we want? So they're visionary opportunists. And they work, it seems to me, by the rules of attraction. Two very simple ways of summing that up. The first is, often in management, or if I'm out of time, Gavin, am I out of time? Two simple ways of summing it up. Often if you're in management, And this is very true of running public sector organisations and companies. It feels like management is propulsion. You come in the morning, you have to pick your rock up, and you have to get your rock from A to B. And the way to get your rock from A to B is to throw it. It's a propulsion business. And that's why I stopped being in management, because it felt like I was being forced to propel people every day. Now imagine that your task is to get a bird from point A to point B. How would you do that? Well, if you spent too much time with McKinsey, you would know that the way to do that is you strap up the bird's wings, you attach a rock to the bottom, and then you throw it. Now imagine that instead of getting a single bird, you've got to get a flock of birds. They're your artists, they're your partners, they're your audience, they're other people you might collaborate with, many of whom you can't control. How do you get them from point A to point B? Well, you have to put bird seed and water at point B. You have to attract them. The more that creativity and innovation depends on collaboration, the more that you have to involve attraction rather than propulsion. Final way of thinking about it. Imagine your task is to run a child's party, a 10-year-old boy's birthday party. If you've read too many of the wrong management textbooks, you will know that the way to do this is, especially if you're in the public sector, is several months before the party, you gather together various stakeholders and you get them together and you try and define some of the key learning goals of the party. And after intense debate, first about who's on the committee and then about the nature of the goals, you whittle them down to 37 key learning goals. When the kids arrive, you give them a sort of performance measure that says when they're going to achieve these goals through the party. Halfway through the party, some inspectors turn up and check that everything's okay. And then it's a modern management party. At the end, you have an after-action review, lessons learned process for knowledge management. Well, not all of that is nonsense, but it's not how you'd organise a party. The way you organise a party is you say, look, this is a party. We're here to celebrate. You set the tone. The tone immediately conveys how people are expected to behave. Next, you set some boundaries. Don't go in that room. Don't throw your sister in the pond. That kind of thing. Thirdly, you give them some attractors. Here's some entertainment. Here's some food. There's a video. You pull them towards things. Fourthly, everyone who's ever run a child's party will know that the number of disputes rises in direct proportion or exponentially in proportion to the number of adults available. The more adults trying to run a party, the more disputes, because the kids call the adults to sort things out. So keep it simple. And set boundaries in a way that kids don't always cross them. So in the public sector, we're dreadful, especially in the centre, at setting boundaries. We set boundaries far too close, so people are always crossing them or think they're crossing them, and then they have to ask for central authority to do so. Setting boundaries too far creates too much risk and uncertainty. So set boundaries in a way that encourages people to move out of where they are and interesting spaces. And then let them self-organise. Ask a child at the end of the party what it was about the party they really loved, and it was probably playing with the other kids. Parties are organised self-organisation. Now, that is what leading complex creative organisations is going to be like in the future. Much more like attraction than propulsion, much more like a party than a route march. That's it. Thank you.